February 27th, 2009. It's the Lullabot Podcast.
Lullabot Podcast.
Episode 71 of the Lullabot Drupal Podcast. We get together every other week or thereabouts. Actually, this one's a little less than a week, so that's exciting. And talk about Drupal. This week on the podcast, we're going to be talking about identity online in general and in specific around Drupal and OpenID and OAuth and the DSO project. We've got Chris Messina coming on, and James Walker is here. Hi, James.
Hey, Jeff.
I'm Jeff Robbins. And but before we bring Chris in, let's do a couple quick announcements. We've got workshops coming up in Providence, Rhode Island, and Portland, Oregon as well.
Yeah, so we mentioned on the last podcast that Providence is happening from March 30th to April 3rd, a combination week of module development and Drupal theming. So that's pretty exciting in Providence, Rhode Island. And just now announced, we're going to go back to Portland, Oregon, the first week of May. So that's May 4th to May 8th. It'll be another combo week of Drupal theming and module development. Both workshops are in early bird pricing, so hop on while the getting's good.
Lullabot.com/training. Yes, and early bird discounts for both Providence, Rhode Island, and Portland, Oregon in effect right now. So go sign up. There's lots more information about those on the Lullabot site. Another announcement we have is, when was it? Probably 6 months ago or so, we put out our first DVD video called Understanding Drupal, sort of a documentary style kind of thing. We'd been talking about doing more sort of tutorial style videos, and as we were talking about assembling those, we realized that there's just a lot of like lingo and understanding of the community and sort of generally how Drupal works that particularly people really new to Drupal need to understand, you know, like even people like your boss, you know, at your company where you're justifying using Drupal. And so that became the Understanding Drupal video, which was sort of a precursor to much more tutorial-oriented, sort of hands-on kind of videos. And we're just putting the finishing touches on the production of a video called Learning CCK and another one called Learning Views, and those will be out next week. The way we did things with the Understanding Drupal video is the same way that we'll do things with these new videos, where you can purchase the DVD or you can purchase it as a download, high definition video download. And the downloads have been really very popular. Look for that also on lullabot.com. Two new videos, I don't know. How would you describe those, James? Tutorial videos, screencasty kind of things. It's sort of a hybrid. We've got.
Yeah, they're much more sort of hands-on than Understanding Drupal was. So there's a lot more screencasts actually walking through, you know how to use CCK and Views, they're great. I watched the rough cut of Learning Views yesterday, and I'm really happy with how it came out. So it's good stuff.
Yeah, we've got a good system for those, and we're going to just keep cranking out more of those kinds of things. So, DrupalCon is happening next week in DC, and we're throwing a party. all the details are still coming together, and as we said on the last podcast, follow Lullabot on Twitter, twitter.com/lullabot. If you're doing Twitter, if you're not doing Twitter, you can get on our mailing list. Go to lullabot.com and there's the mailing list sign up there somewhere on the page, and we'll let you know about the details for that as they come together and as we announce them. And while you're on Twitter, you know, you really should follow James.
I was waiting for that. No, follow Jeff. He needs it.
Well, the Lullabot account's passing both of us. We can't compete.
Nope. We're losing to an automated bot.
Yes. What's your Twitter account, James?
It's Walkah, WALKAH, which is me on Twitter, me on Drupal.org, me in IRC, and me most places on the web. So
that you really have your identity together, don't you?
I do.
I do pretty well with that too. I'm Jay Jeff on Twitter and everywhere else, pretty much, jjf.com as well. Double J, single E, double F. There you go. Nice. We on the last podcast, we talked about doing a Drupal 7, sort of catching up with podcasts. And if you're tuning into this podcast saying, hey, where's that podcast? The answer is still coming up, probably be the next podcast. There's a usability sprint that's going on as sort of a precursor to DrupalCon DC, and a bunch of the Lullabots are down there doing that. So we decided to put off the Drupal 7 one till we could get a little more.
Yeah, it doesn't feel right to talk about what's coming in Drupal 7 without the Drupal 7 maintainer on the podcast.
Yeah, we're going to get Angie on here for that. So, but we've got Chris Messina. Let's bring him in and talk a bit about identity. Hi, Chris. Thanks for coming on.
Hey, thanks, guys.
Where are we talking to you from?
I am in the jungle in the sub-Sahara. Kidding. Hear birds and flyovers and things like that. It's actually because I'm somewhere deep in the gut of Florida.
Yes, the wily jungles of Florida.
That's right.
Well, thanks for coming on and talking to us, and thanks also for coming to New Orleans and speaking at the Drupal seminar. James and I were just talking. I think what we're going to do is we're going to take your video and put it up as one of the free videos.
Awesome.
So people can go to doitwithdrupal.com and see Chris talking about open web stuff and DSO in particular.
That'd be great.
We'll define all these things, but I just wanted to sort of mention that. What are we talking about today? We're going to talk sort of about identity and sort of the identity related stuff. Both Chris, you and James here have done a lot of talking about those kind of things. You're actually both talking at DrupalCon next week about this. Chris, you're keynoting. That's exciting.
As it turns out, yes.
As it turns out, it is exciting.
And it is true too.
Yeah, I don't know. Where should we start this whole thing? Let's start with some sort of definitions and sort of the glossary of terms around all of this.
Yeah, okay. I'd actually like to jump in with a first question, because although I've known Chris for a lot of years, going back way far, I think a lot of especially newer users to Drupal might not know some of sort of Chris's history and how he got here. So maybe, Chris, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Chris's sordid past in Drupal.
Sordid past in Drupal, yeah.
It's kind of a past that has repeated itself as I've gone to other open source projects. So I think I sort of, broke all my teeth at Drupal, and then I, went to these other projects and found, well, a lot of open source are sort of like, they operate the same way. Let me sort of explain what I mean. I actually started out at Drupal by meeting Zach Rosen, who I knew from Pittsburgh, actually, and he worked on the Howard Dean presidential campaign and Dean Space software, which then became Civic Space. And he and I happened to be out at San Francisco around the same time, and unbeknownst to both of us, and he's like, hey, Chris, why don't you come do some design for us? And so that's actually how I got involved with Civic Space. So back in, I think, 2004, many, many years ago now, before we have the president that we have today, we were working on the software to help people organize grassroots political campaigns and things like that. Of course, all back-ended on Drupal. And around the same time, it just so happened that the Mozilla Foundation was thinking like, oh, wouldn't it be great if we could sort of catalyze the many, you know, Firefox supporters around the world through sort of a grassroots marketing campaign, a la the Howard Dean campaign. And they decided to use the open source Civic Space platform to do that. And so I happened to sort of be in the perfect place at the right time, being able to do and parlay the design work that I was doing on Civic Space around some of the usability issues and things like that with Drupal into the design work that I did on the Spread Firefox project. So that was sort of like my early exposure and experience with Drupal, trying to, you know, it's funny to sort of think about how little I understood of the platform at the time, but how much I wanted to try to, you know, squeeze this massive bucket of bolts into something that, you know, looked something like a motor scooter, you know, that people could actually use. You know, failing to realize that, you know, this is like core plumbing stuff. So anyways, that's where I was. And it's funny because I had such a hard time really promoting design and taking options away and taking features away back then. And I think Drupal's actually come a long way since then in terms of becoming at least much more of a usable platform where design is something that's taken very seriously, and usability is something that's a hot topic lately. So anyways, that's I guess where I've come from with regards to Drupal.
Yeah, I remember that. You were a bit of a lone voice back then.
I was basically a pain in the ass.
I remember getting really excited about what you were saying, but it really stood out as.
I remember JavaScript used to be the enemy, and that was
Yeah, wow. I remember. I pine frequently about the basement in Belgium where we did the first DrupalCon, and
all right.
Poor Chris standing alone saying, you know, we should be using JavaScript. We should be thinking about usability. And everybody's just like, yeah, we're
whatever design guy.
Yeah, exactly. Whatever design guy. So let's fast forward though, 5 years, and now you left Civic Space and went on to, I believe Flock was immediately after Civic
Space. That's
right. Space for you. And, yeah. And then sort of, so here you are 5 years later, crossing paths with the Drupal community under sort of a completely different, under a completely different topic, and sort of as somebody, you know, you work with Vidoop, who does sort of identity management stuff as part of their company offering, and you founded co-founded, I guess, the Dezo project for doing distributed social networking. How did sort of all that come to be?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, all of this to me is actually sort of along the same trajectory. I think, you know, I love technology and I love being involved in technology, but technology is only as good as it's usable. And that's sort of been the two topics that I've had to straddle for the last several years, you know, starting with Drupal and Civic Space and seeing this great, powerful platform that ultimately, didn't reach its potential, I think, because it was not as usable as it needed to be. You know, and I think that the best intentions of developers and technologists often die in those last few, you know, that last 5% effort that makes something accessible to a larger number of people. So when I left Civic Space and Mozilla and the Spread Firefox project, I decided, you know, well, the browser is one thing that hasn't been updated in a long, long time. I mean, you basically have the same core components that you've always had. Wouldn't it make more sense to add people into the browser? And so that's kind of where the concept for Flock came from. And I worked on that project for about 9 months and, you know, just wasn't getting the kind of support from the rest of the company that I needed, I think, to sort of realize this vision. And they thought that MySpace was going to be, you know, the next and only big thing. And, you know, I decided, you know, that's really not what's interesting to me. I want to do something that actually is part of the fabric of the web, you know. As lately I've tended to say, the web is the largest social network, or maybe I got that from Dave Recorden. But anyways, it's true, right? And so you have all these great technologies, but they're not usable. So at some point, I was talking to Steve Ivey, who now works at Six Apart, about how, you know, Tontek, our good dear friend, talks about how microformats can rule the world and do all these great things and so on. And I'm very sympathetic to his arguments about making the web sort of a better, richer, more semantic place. But the reality is that I just haven't seen enough actual user-facing solutions. So the Diesel project was sort of saying, hey, look, you know, now that we have OpenID sort of as established out there, there's a WordPress plugin that allows us to do it, and we've got microformats, which allow you to mark up your web pages in more meaningful ways. If I create a public list of my friends, and those friends are listed as URLs, and those people with those URLs come to my blog and leave a comment, wouldn't it be nice if I could also provide them access to some private data without forcing them to sign up for my personal social network necessarily? And of course, also you see people starting to establish their identity on MySpace or Facebook or places like that, and then running out of runway in terms of the flexibility or the desire to sort of customize it to meet their needs, or even just to sort of be able to establish their own unique identity outside of a social network. So the challenge for us was, well, could we do something that builds on these core building blocks that allows us to, or gives people sort of like fundamental choice in where they host their own identity? And that's kind of where the Diesel project came from. And I worked on that for quite a while. Well, I don't know, 6 months or so. And then I was having a conversation with Scott Kubitin, who was at Bidoop, and he and I had done work on Spread Firefox together. And he's like, hey, you know, why don't you come join us and, you know, sort of work on this full time and like, you know, push this conversation forward. And that's how I ended up there. And then this past December, I was elected to the board of the OpenID Foundation. And I'm sort of helping to maybe catalyze that brand a bit and make this stuff make more sense to mere mortals who don't steal this stuff every day. I don't know how successful I'm being, but hopefully over time we'll get there.
Well, let's make it make sense to mere mortals. Let's start with let's define some of these things. So how would we define OpenID? You know, what are the practical uses of it, and kind of a little bit of the technology behind how it works?
Sure. I think the easiest way to understand OpenID, you know, is the ability to use an account that you have on one website on another website without having to create a new password. That's sort of like the most pragmatic, most basic benefit that, especially in today's environment where you have so many passwords and so many accounts, you can immediately see the value of that. What that means, you know, is that you can establish your identity at a place like, you know, Google, or Yahoo, AOL, MySpace, places like that that actually support this protocol. And then when you go to another website, let's say some banned website like SnoopDogg.com, you can say, well, I don't want to create just a SnoopDogg.com username and password because I'm probably going to forget it, you know, 5 minutes after I leave, but I'll reuse one of my existing accounts, and then you can just sign in that way. What's also important to think about is the parallel to email. You know, people don't have an email address for every different website that they sign up for. You know, they have, you know, maybe 1, 2, 3 inboxes, probably is around the average, you know, 1 or 2 is probably at most. And you use those different emails for different purposes. So OpenID sort of follows in that path by allowing you to have more flexibility in your identity. So in contrast, Facebook and Facebook Connect sort of have the notion that, well, you have one identity, you are one complete person, you will use that identity everywhere that you go on the web. That supports Facebook Connect. And while that, I think, creates a very usable solution because it removes the ability to choose who hosts your identity, that is not going to work long-term for everybody. So right. I guess part of this is creating a reusable, open, non-proprietary building block that can go anywhere the web goes.
Yeah. So I think, so I've been doing, you know, a fair bit of work with OpenID over the past couple of years, and including presentations at every DrupalCon since 2007. And yeah, one of the things that I've tried to sort of explain to people, because I think there still is even today a lot of misconceptions about not so much about what OpenID is, but what it isn't. You know, in that, you know, really what OpenID is, your identifier, it is sort of, it's just a way to reliably say, you know, this account is the same. You know, it's the same person logged in here as this OpenID who is over there, which, you know, when you stop to think about it, gives us a lot of interesting things, particularly from a social networking point of view, around, you know, being able to reliably, you know, aggregate people across services and out in the open. But it's not, you know, it's not a whole bunch of other things. And so, you know, I think with the DZO project, you know, there's a bunch of other interesting pieces, and probably the most interesting right now is OAuth. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about what OAuth sort of brings to the mix.
Absolutely. So OpenID is really around identity. You know, who are you? Who do you, you know, say you are, and then going back and proving it. OAuth has a nice kind of dovetail to OpenID in that once you know who someone is, then it's about getting authorization to access someone's data, whatever that happens to be. So you first identify yourself to a service, and the next step is, okay, now I know who you are. I've seen you before. I would like to have access to, let's say, your friends so I can tell you where they are on this website, or I want to access your photos, or I want to access your feeds, or things like that, which may or may not be, you know, private. So OAuth kind of specifies a way of providing what we call delegated access to your data in a way that you as an individual have more control over. And the way in which it does that is by assigning essentially a unique valet key to your data to each service that you use. So what that means, and this has sort of been very topical with regards to Twitter, you know, is that all these Twitter applications on the web that you use to, let's say, post status updates or to bring in your friends and provide your recommendations or what have you. I mean, there's hundreds of these applications. Most traffic to Twitter actually comes from these third-party applications. The problem is that all of them require but ask for, at some point, your username and password. And what that means is that you're essentially giving those third parties who you may or may not trust or who may or may not have good data protection, hygiene, and things like that, the same level of power that you have over your same account. So they could go in and log in to Twitter on your behalf, for example, and do really useful things. Or let's say there's some, you know, script kiddie hacker that happens to break into one of these third-party sites because they forgot to, you know, patch some server. And now that kid can go in and change your password so that you're locked out of your Twitter account. They can delete your Twitter account. They can change your username. All these different things that are really bad. And we saw, you know, what can happen when these types of credentials are leaked a few weeks ago when some very high profile Twitter users had their accounts broken into. So that's sort of one very simple example. But more importantly, this is about letting people, and I think the context here is that we're moving more and more to web services for a lot of the things that we're trying to do with computers. And the metaphor that I use is that we're moving away from kind of like this desktop where you have like a C drive on your PC that stores all of your photos and your videos, and you know, you just, everything is, of course, you can access everything there because you are the one user that controls all those different services, to a model where you're on the web and you're using Flickr, using Facebook for storing your photos, you're using YouTube for your videos, and so on. And now when you go to this third-party service that, as you said, sort of wants to aggregate your data, you now have to figure out a way of conveniently telling that service where all your stuff exists. And it's great if you only use one service for everything, but it's not always the case that one service is going to service all the different needs that you have for data storage. So once you identify who you are, then you should be able to then say, well, and here are all the different things and all the different services that I use that store my data, and here's a convenient and consistent way for me to provide you access to parts of that data that I can then later revoke if I want to.
Right. So yeah. Let's look at some sort of practical uses, examples of these things, so that people can, you know, maybe relate a little bit more if they're still having trouble sort of following. OpenID, one of the really cool things about OpenID is you're not sharing your passwords. You're not, you know, you go, let's say you go, an example would be you go to a website, some sort of sketchy website, and maybe it's a new, yet another new Web 2.0 website, that, you know, and they want you to create an account. If they offer OpenID, what you can do is say, okay, I'm going to log in with my OpenID information. You instead enter in what is essentially a URL to your OpenID provider. It works slightly different with different providers, but basically you type that in. And then you get redirected to that OpenID provider page, web page, which is actually where you log in. You enter in your ID. I use one called myopenid.com. Yahoo now provides this service. I guess AOL is doing this now. So if you have anybody that has a Yahoo account, for example, you just type yahoo.com, right? In there, it'll bring you to Yahoo. You log in with your Yahoo ID, and then it will bring you back to the website where you started this whole process, and you will be magically logged in, and they will have created an account for you and might even have some profile information for you. Is that correct?
Yeah, it depends. Sure. If you basically, and that's one of the other nice things, is that eventually you're able to create a profile in one place and reuse it over and over again.
Right.
And longer term, you should be able to update your profile on your core identity and have it propagate to these other sites in a way that's convenient, in a way that you control.
Right. And so it's you're not sharing your passwords. It's more secure, but it's also a more reliable proof that you are who you say you are. You're providing a canonical location. If I say this OpenID provider is providing my ID with this username, I could go to any web service and I could sign up as Waka or Factory Joe, and they wouldn't know necessarily that it wasn't you guys. But I couldn't do that with OpenID.
Right.
That's right.
Yeah, that does sort of start to touch on a bit of gray area where people start to get confused, is that what it says is that you are the same account owner.
Right.
So if I'm sort of well established as Waka.net, which is what I use for my OpenID on most places, then anything where I've signed in with my OpenID is going to be me as well. One of the gray areas is just because I have an OpenID that says I am, President Obama, doesn't mean that I'm actually President Obama. And it's sort of a tricky, subtle distinction. But all OpenID is really claiming is that this is, the account on this site is the person who owns this identifier.
Right.
And then
OAuth, is this short for open authorization? Yes.
Basically.
One of those things. It could stand for several different things.
Do they
tell us still that DVD stands for digital versatile disc? It's not a video disc because it's more versatile than that. Anyways, OAuth, whatever it stands for. An example of that would be I go to a website that wants to... wants to know my location or do stuff with my Twitter data. Twitter is not a good example because they don't quite have this yet, but
they will soon
thanks to the pressuring of Chris Messina. So I go to this website, and in the past this website would have said, give me your Twitter user ID and your password so that I can go in through the Twitter APIs and get your whatever information it needs to get, your list of friends or all of your past posts or whatever is
your direct messages.
Yeah, your direct messages is a good one, right? Private information that might not be out there on the web. But if we now substitute OAuth instead, the process works very similar to the OpenID login system, where I go to this website, it says, okay, we're going to redirect you to Twitter, where you will log in on Twitter, and Twitter will then, in the background, authorize us to get your information.
Yep, that's right. And the other thing that's important there is that it scopes the request. So another good example of this, and where OAuth, I think, has its greatest use today, is... whenever you join a new social network, and I think, this is actually very pertinent to Drupal sites that want to allow people to invite their friends, you know, is that usually the second step after you've signed up is, oh, you know, give us your username and password for your email account, and we'll slurp in your address book and invite all your friends for you. Mm-hmm. Now, there's some major problems with that model for a number of reasons. I mean, first of all, it's not always the case that you want to provide all of your contacts and your address book to a remote party site. But of course, if they have your username and password, they have access to all the same data that you do. The other problem with this, especially with sites like Google, where you have essentially one username and password, is that that username and password unlocks all of your other accounts as well. And that includes your Google Docs and your Google Analytics. But more importantly, over time, that also tends to unlock things like your Google Health account.
And your, and so, your browser history, every website you've ever been to. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. So what you want to be able to do, instead of providing access to all of that information to some, you know, Johnny-come-lately kind of site, you know, is say, well, I would like you to tell me where my friends are on this site, and I only want to provide you access to that simple piece of information and nothing else. And so OAuth is a way of actually scoping the request to a finite set of information that at some later point, you know, if that website gets sold or if you no longer use the site, you can revoke access.
Yeah. Yeah, that's actually the scoping, as well as the fact that it's per sort of per application, right? I mean, one of the big things that's happened with Twitter, but and I'm glad you brought up the email thing, because I actually think it's the much more sort of telling example, is all the people, you know, entering their full Gmail access details every time they sign up for a new site. But the other interesting thing is, right now, if you do that for Twitter, do it with your email account, you know, you have one username and password that is your access. So every application that you've installed or every new site that you've given this information to, if you give it to one bad one, you have to change that information for all of the sites. You know, so there's been a couple sort of high-profile scares that you mentioned with Twitter, where people have to go, you know, everybody's advised to go update your Twitter, your Twitter password if you've used this nasty service or this suspect service. And now what you have to do is any other application or any other service that you want to use, that you do trust, that you've given your Twitter information to, you now have to go update with them with your new password. Whereas OAuth, our application, every new service you sign up for, you're authorizing just that application to, you know, just this bit of information. I think one of the things that I'm not sure we've said explicitly is the biggest flip here is giving users a lot more say and a lot more control, and sort of bringing the web back to people. And for me, I mean, that's sort of my you know, my point of enthusiasm around it, is that rather than leaving all of these choices up to, you know, up to Facebook and up to, you know, whoever else, Twitter and everybody else, you know, with this sort of OpenID and OAuth sort of OpenStack model, I all of a sudden get a lot more control over, you know, who I am on the internet and who has access to which information.
But, you know, it's also about providing people with a better experience. And I think that that's actually something that needs to be understood here, is that if you provide people with better tools and a better understanding of the process of what's happening, as opposed to providing the services sort of with, like, carte blanche, you actually, I think, end up creating longer retention and better relationships. So there are a lot of sites that, for whatever reason, decide to then not only slurp in your address book, but as part of step two, of course, because they have your full credentials, to go and send an email on your behalf to all of your friends, which of course may not have been the thing that you wanted to do, especially if your boss is in there, you know, or, you know, ex-girlfriends and things like that. So what you want to do instead is say, well, again, I just want you to show me who of my friends are on this site already, and I will connect with them. And then if I want to send an invite to them, I can do so on my own, you know, through some other tool. So this is essentially separating your identity from your access. And I think that's why these technologies go so well together, is because they're finally actually separating those two things in a way that provides individual people better, ultimately, a better user experience.
Yeah. So, and I'd love to talk about that, because I think that's one thing that a lot of people are still, you know, sort of daunted by, mostly by the OpenID experience. You know, there's a lot of sort of misunderstanding about, you know, knowing what your, you know, what URL you're supposed to put in, and how you're supposed to use it and things like that. But one of the sort of, so there's been a lot of work, and you've been sort of very deeply involved in a lot of it. But I think sort of the first thing is that people probably aren't aware of is something that I believe Google gets credit for sort of claiming it first, although maybe it was Plexo or maybe they did it together. But this OpenID OAuth hybrid that people in some corners of the internet are talking about, you know, explain a little bit what that sort of looks like.
Sure. So that actually was sort of a complete collaboration between Plexo and Google. And it's been very interesting to see how Plexo has sort of turned around the organization in many respects over the last several years, since they used to have a pretty bad reputation around this stuff, to being a leading advocate for people having a bit more control over how they sort of disseminate their information. It turns out that by giving people more control over this, it's actually good for Plexo's business. And the specific case here is, in the case where, let's say I go to Plexo, and, you know, James, you're not a Plexo user yet, but I'm using it to manage my address book, and I would like you to, update your information, and I invite you to the service, and you happen to be a Gmail user. So I'll caveat this by saying this currently is really a Plexo Google flow, but it's one that, because it's using open standards, can be done for any other service that implements these protocols. So anyways, you receive this invite email, and Plexo knows, since it sent the invite, that you are a Gmail user. So it essentially provides a special URL for you for this invitation that allows you to click a button and essentially sign in to Plexo using your Google OpenID. And during this flow, because again, Google is now an OpenID provider, during this flow, there is also an OAuth request that is attached to that OpenID authentication flow. So you essentially are going over to Google, you're signing in, and the very next step says, and would you like to allow Plexo to have access to your address book? And you say, well, that's cool. You know, I want to know who my friends are on Plexo. So you're doing the sign-in. You're authorizing Plexo to have access to your address book. And you're brought back around to Plexo without having ever had to create a brand new account and filling in all your profile information all in one click. Well, basically two clicks. And what's interesting here is that the number one place where sign-ups drop off and conversions drop off is in that, you know, either send someone an email invite or send them an email confirmation to prove that, yes, this is actually their email address. You know, people just get lost. The email gets sent to spam, all these different things. And so you can imagine that conversion rates on those types of things are, you know, 60 to 70% if you're lucky, much lower for other services. In this case, Plexo was able to see a pretty incredible figure in terms of signups and completions here of both creating these new accounts using OpenID and then getting access to the address books to invite more friends at an order of 92%, you know, which is unheard of on the web. It's like, you know, 92% of anything is just ridiculous. And so this was done sort of as an experiment. They're like, well, we'll send this out to like the next 1,000 people that show up and then we'll turn it off. But it was so successful that the business people actually said, nah, no way, you're not turning this off. This is great. So here you have a situation where no new passwords are being created on Plexo. People are reusing their existing Google accounts because, of course, they're already in Gmail. I mean, that's where they got the email from. And the whole flow basically is a whole lot more seamless. So in this case, it actually has real business value to consider using these types of technologies in these types of cases.
I should give Plexo another try. Yeah. It seemed to be so all-encompassing because of that same stuff. I mean, it was like they wanted all my information. They wanted all my logins to all this stuff. I mean, this was, what, a year ago, year and a half ago, something like that. And I mean, it really changes your relationship with a lot of these services when you feel like they're being less intrusive in that way, that they can get some of the information without needing to get all of your logins and all of your information. Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
How does all of this play in with DSO?
So the DSO project is a couple of different things. I mean, on the one hand, it's a tool that I can use sort of as a conversation framer. So, you know, Google has a framework or platform essentially called Open Social, which is a series of technologies and protocols designed to enable, in some ways, distributed social networking. I'm a little unclear about the overall picture that Open Social paints over the long term, largely because it is very much associated with Google. And I know that there are, like Kevin Marks would argue with me about that, but Google, of course, is leading the way in making that happen, largely because they're putting resources into it. And so that's actually a really good thing. The DSO project were around starting that conversation and saying, you know, the social web is the internet itself. So how can we allow for a Drupal site, a WordPress site, a movable type site to all interoperate and, you know, not share user accounts per se, but allow people to sign up between these sites without having to create brand new accounts that only exist in one place. So it's that part. It's framing the conversation. And the other part is helping to catalyze the development of a number of these protocols. So I would argue that OAuth was sort of part of where we needed to go with the DSO project in order for that to happen. And so fortunately we've seen a lot of adoption of OAuth at large providers. In fact, it's part of Open Social now. It's also meant that I've spent time working on like the Portable Contacts protocol, which is a standard way of moving address books between different networks. It means that I've been working on this other format called Activity Streams, where we're trying to essentially expand Atom in a very slight way to encompass the verbs and the actors and the objects that are being sort of carried around in these in essentially regular feeds. And the DSO project longer term will help to implement some of these protocols as plugins for different platforms. So we're starting with WordPress, largely because it's something that I'm familiar with, and there's already a good, you know, install base there who are willing to install and experiment with new plugins. I would love to see a lot more involvement actually from the Drupal community, which is sort of what I talked about at the Do It with Drupal conference, and I've been sort of poking Waka for a long time to see if we can do more interop between our plugins and what he's been working on. And then, of course, Dave Recordin, who works at Six Apart, has been instrumental, as well as Steve Ivey, who is the co-founder of the DSO project, have been fairly instrumental in moving the conversation forward by both improving and helping to work on the OpenID user experience, but also shipping something called Motion, which is kind of an activity streams aggregator, and other parts of movable type that are baking these features, you know, as sort of first-class citizens into those platforms. So in many ways, it's kind of like, these are the different things that need to move forward. And I have to admit, I'm a very scattered sort of person around these things. So I haven't seen as much progress as I'd like to see. But it is a way of saying, you know, the way that we're dealing with the walled social gardens today is not the way that, I'm sorry, the walled social networks, whatever. Gardens, there's, things like that, yeah.
Mixed metaphors.
There's gnomes, that's all I know.
Yeah.
You know, is how can we just, you know, move this stuff forward? Because it's the case today where I can be on Gmail and send someone who's on Yahoo or Hotmail an email, and I don't have to sign up for one of those accounts. Someday it'll be the case where you can do the same thing with social networks, where I have an account on Facebook and someone has an account on MySpace or someplace else, and I can still share rich information with them. I can still allow them to see my private photo galleries and things like that, largely because we have these reusable building blocks that can be implemented, you know, one at a time or as a complete stack, which essentially is what the OpenStack is all about.
Yeah. For me, I think one of the reasons I'm excited about the DSO project is I think it brings a much better framing to sort of the OpenStack and to these different individual technologies. I think it starts to make will, as it gets a little further down the road, will start to make more sense to people as to, you know, why the individual pieces are important if they're sort of making up a bit of a, you know, a bit more of a coherent whole, or people can see. Because I mean, I think, you know, with OpenID in particular, we've gotten sort of, you know, some significant adoption in people, you know, on sort of great sales pitches like, you know, you don't need to remember as many passwords and things like that. But for me, I think OpenID opens much broader doors, right? It enables much more interesting sort of interactions on the web. And what DSO does is sort of starts to collect a bunch of these under an umbrella and give each of them some context as to where they fit in some of this I did want to bring up sort of, you know, maybe a bit of an elephant in the room, because I think a lot of the stuff we're talking about has, in terms of some of the user experience, has a sort of new competitor in Facebook Connect, which offers a lot of this stuff. And maybe, you know, maybe you could talk about how Dizo relates to Facebook. Because I know there's been all kinds of, you know, Facebook recently joined I forget the terminology now, but they're somehow a member organization with the OpenID Foundation, as well as they hosted a big user experience summit. And yet Facebook Connect is arguably sort of a direct competitor to Dizo.
Openness.
Yeah.
Well, so yes, there's a very interesting sort of shift that's happening. At least I hope, you know, it's a real shift. And Facebook, as of a couple weeks ago, did join the OpenID Foundation as a corporate board member. And what that means is that they essentially dropped $50,000 on the organization, on the OpenID Foundation, to become a corporate member, and that provides them with one seat at the board. And the way that the OpenID board works is that we always have the number of corporate members plus one in terms of community representation. So I think we have something like 7 corporate board members now. That means that we have 8 community representatives, of which I am one. So what this means is that Facebook is now very much a part of this conversation, and it is my impression, given the way that they've talked about their involvement in the OpenID Foundation, is that they actually want to do OpenID. They, of course, haven't announced any plans, and there's no, you know, certainty about this, but I don't think that they would be involved in and investing in and hosting an event like the OpenID Design Workshop if they didn't both see the promise and see the reason to go in this direction. Now, there is absolutely, you know, the question around, well, isn't there a competition between these two technologies? And in the short term, there is. I mean, from a mindshare perspective, there is. You know, developers are only going to do one thing or another. As we see, we don't have a lot of sort of hybrid Drupal WordPress developers. You kind of like pick your framework and you go with it. The same thing's true with Facebook Connect and OpenID, or at least it seems to be that way. On the flip side of that, Facebook Connect gets the user experience right by dispensing with choice. And as I mentioned before, it isn't the case that somebody's Facebook account is the one that they want to use on every different website across the web. And so these websites that support Facebook Connect eventually end up in the situation where someone says, well, I use my Facebook account for my personal relationships, and this is a site that's for business contacts. And so if you're only allowing me the ability to use my Facebook account, I'm not going to use this site because I have another account, which, let's say, hopefully supports OpenID, that I would prefer to use here. And by taking away that choice, I'm no longer interested in actually using your service. And so hopefully Facebook sort of understands that and realizes, you know, even though they have a very strong faith in identity and single identity and user identity and portable identity, they also recognize that one way of disrupting the conversation is to just sort of put the protocol and technology conversation aside and actually support the open technology. Now, there's a real interesting thing here, and this is sort of what I've experienced in having conversations with people at Facebook, is that there's also a generational shift that if you want to understand the future, I think you need to take a look at the people within these organizations. I mean, Facebook is a young company, and I mean that not just in terms of its age, but also in terms of the age of its employees. Right. And the conversations that I've had with people, especially the engineers and developers, tend to be around both understanding and appreciating and living and breathing open source. So while there are lots of parts of Facebook that are not open source, there are parts that I think that people within Facebook would like to see become open source. They've benefited from open source a lot. They talk about open source. They talk about openness and sharing and all these different things in the same conversation. So from that perspective, I actually think that there is a desire.
We'll let the airplane go by.
Exactly. So I think there's actually a desire within Facebook to be real way to actually lower the cost and the friction for designers and developers. However, as you pointed out, the user experience for OpenID today is not at par with the Facebook Connect experience.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, Facebook has the nice advantage of they can just stick a button on there that says, you know, it's got some minimal Facebook branding and just says Connect, and you click the button, and it's very sort of clear from that button what you're doing, you know, that you're using your Facebook credentials to log in, and you just click the button. Yeah.
And that's the way it is today. Yeah. Out of this user experience and user interface design workshop, we came up with some guidelines, or at least started some guidelines, which have now led into a working group within the foundation to actually move that work forward to the point where it could be that, you know, you click a button to sign into some website. There's a pop-up, just like in Facebook Connect. Once you see that pop-up, now you choose a button to the provider that you want to use, or you click an OpenID button that allows you to specify, let's say, your own OpenID, and you do the entire authentication flow in a pop-up. And there's some reasons for that, and there's actually some design affordances that are pretty interesting. So specifically, when you click that button, what will happen is the screen that you originally clicked will sort of go dim, so it's like the light box thing. A new pop-up will show up, allow you to authenticate. The whole time, you have to be able to see the URL bar. So that's one of the other parts of the specification, is that even though a lot of people don't necessarily look at the URL, that is something that we want to at least allow people to have the option to see. But of course, really with phishing, I mean, you could do the whole OpenID authentication flow in an iframe, but then you don't really know if you're logging into your OpenID provider or someone who looks like your OpenID provider. And of course, that's been a problem lately. So we do this pop-up, you do that whole flow, you finish, and there's a really interesting kind of little hack that allows you to return the user to the page that they first opened and not refresh that page. So you essentially just do some inline replacement with JavaScript that replaces like the sign in button with something that says sign out. And you replace the, you know, welcome unknown user with, you know, welcome Chris. And you populate the page based on now the logged in user. So the flow is actually pretty nice. And there's a couple demos that are out there on the web. If you search for OpenID pop-up demo or something like that, you'll see it. But we're making a lot of progress, and we're getting to the point where, you know, you can use buttons to sign into some of the major providers. We have found that about 70% of people on some sites have at least one of in Yahoo, AOL, Google, you know, MySpace account. So if anybody wants to use those accounts, great. You know, that's 70% of your audience. You might as well make it easy for them and give them buttons. And then everybody else, you know, they can either use their own OpenID or something like that. But the other thing that we found is that, and this is research that's come out of Janrain, the folks who make myopenid.com, they deployed their RPX solution across a number of Universal Music websites. And so basically these Universal sites are all relying parties for OpenID. They found that a lot of their users use a number of different OpenID providers, and in fact it varies based on the type of site that has OpenID support. So there's a site called User Voice, which allows you to specify or to provide feedback for a website. Most of the people who used User Voice were logging in with their Google account, something like 30 or 40%. Whereas, I don't know if it was like, you know, Puff Daddy or Snoop Dogg or whatever, obviously, most of those people were using MySpace. So
interesting.
This is one of those reasons why it's not just a matter of like saying, oh, we're just going to do Facebook Connect because everybody has Facebook Connect. Well, actually, that's not entirely true. And why would you want to, you know, limit your potential audience to any one of those service providers? You know, it would be useful for people considering supporting OpenID to go through their database and look at all the email domains and to essentially do a graph to see, you know, what are the top email domains for people signing up for my service? And that should give you an idea of why OpenID is an open protocol that works with the web as it is today is a longer-term solution to the question of, well, how do I make it easier for people to sign up for my service than Facebook Connect, which is kind of like, you know, today's version of Prodigy or CompuServe.
Right. Yeah, I think that's fascinating. I mean, that validates so many of sort of the assumptions that we've been working on, right? That that people will actually want to be able to choose and will be selective about which identity they use on different services. I hadn't actually read that. That's fascinating.
It was really, really good to see. You know, and I think if you go to blog.janrain.com, you can actually find the stats and the charts. But it was you know, what we need more now as well, and I think within the Drupal community, it'd be really interesting to see this, is those types of anecdotal reports where, you know, and I think about what Warner Brothers has done with using Drupal across all their sites. I'm sure they would have very interesting stats to say, well, you know, 40% of our people come from, you know, Yahoo, and 30% come from, you know, Hotmail, and, you know, any number of these other services, but to sort of just demonstrate the point where you don't want to limit yourself to just one provider.
So, yeah, I mean, the problem with all of these, you could see the problem with using something like Facebook. I mean, it's for this as opposed to something open. Facebook has their own needs, their own specific stuff. They have their own terms of service, which could potentially change over time. There was a whole debacle about that recently. We should talk about a little bit. By using the OpenID technology, it's much easier to conceivably even swap out which OpenID provider you are using to provide your ID. It's very what would be the word? Non-committal, I guess. You know, you're
Portable and again centering around this idea of user centricity, right? So I mean, Chris, I don't know if you want to talk about sort of what happened in this book for those that didn't hear, but it's a good example of why really sort of having a user own their identity is important, rather than having sort of having other sites own your identity.
Sure. So to provide sort of context for this, Facebook has had kind of a pretty, you know, typical terms of service for a long time. I doubt most people actually read the terms of service when they sign up for social networks, but consumerists happened to notice a change in Facebook's terms of service that happened at the beginning of February. And essentially what happened was that Facebook deleted a paragraph that promised you as a user of Facebook that you could always delete your account. Essentially that your data was yours, and if you wanted to leave the site, you could leave it and Facebook would get rid of all your stuff. And that of course, is nice in theory, and it's great if Facebook continued or wanted to stay a walled garden. But as they are pushing this openness and sharing concept, there also have to be changes in terms of the legal aspects of sharing. It's not as cut and dry as you might think. So what this means and why Facebook had to change their terms of service, and then, of course, they changed them back after user revolt. And I'm sure in not too long they'll change them back again to no longer have that language. But the point is, they didn't really tell anybody about it. They just kind of did it. So the problem is what happens once you start sharing your data with your friends? And what happens when your friends start then importing your data, which you've given them lease to some third-party website that is no longer owned or controlled by Facebook? So a simple example, FriendFeed is kind of an aggregator of people's activities across the web. What if, you know, I provided you, James, you know, access to my status updates and my wall and all that information on my newsfeed? So you're aggregating all this stuff, you know, you see my new photos and you see the stuff that I'm posting, my links and all the stuff. But you're like, you know, Facebook's great and all, but I just don't use it that much. I prefer FriendFeed's interface. So I'm going to take the feed of my friends from Facebook into the FriendFeed. It's more convenient. That's where I hang out. Now, for some reason, I decide that I want to delete my Facebook account. You know, I've had it. I don't want to use it anymore. Something strange happens. Who knows? I go in there and I delete my Facebook account. Now, the problem is that all the data that I shared with you previously is still on FriendFeed servers. So with Facebook's previous terms of service, if I then found out that my data was over on FriendFeed and that you still had access to it, theoretically, I would have a case against Facebook for not doing what they said they were going to do based on the terms of service. So as data starts becoming more mobile or portable and going beyond the walls of the garden and leaking through the cracks, it becomes a lot harder for Facebook to actually control who has access to what. The same thing's true, you know, for example, with like address book information and so on. So there is a major shift, I think, that's coming conceptually and in terms of the way that people approach privacy, that what's most interesting and most valuable is like the data that is happening both in real time and access to data into the future. At least that's my contention. There will be a generational shift and a generational disconnect in terms of wanting to have absolute, utter control over your data. But I think that the ways in which you achieve absolute and utter control over your data is through things like DRM. And we just, over time, you just find that DRM is really bad, both for individual users, for the owners of the content, typically. You know, if you forget your key, you're locked out of your stuff. You know, if you use file vaults on some old computer and you forget the password, you know, you're kind of screwed. And it's also really bad for data longevity. So, you know, similar to the file vault example, you can imagine being able to, you know, or wanting to get access to some data at a later point. And if the keys are gone, you know, that data is essentially encrypted. You can't access it. So one of the changes here, and we see this even in the Obama administration, is a desire to move towards transparency, because we frankly will not be able to deal with the sheer amount of information that's out there and trying to sort of pick the needle from the haystack that also happens to be encrypted.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, to your point, with OpenID, the idea is that you should be able to pick your provider of choice. And it's been my contention that the openness in the protocol is essential in order to ensure long-term freedom of choice and competition in the marketplace. For example, if all email were done with proprietary closed protocols that people were not allowed to implement, then Gmail would never actually be able to exist. And for a lot of people, Gmail is like a lifesaver. It's like the best product that they've ever used for email. We should have the same type of rich competitive marketplace in terms of OpenID providers that we have in the email space. Yeah. And you should also have the ability of moving your email from one provider to a new provider if that provider is providing you with a better service.
Right. Yeah. In OpenID talks that I generally give, although I've morphed it a little over the year because, you know, who wants to hear the same talk? But the first one I did in Sunnyvale back in 2007 was a direct and intentional play on Dick Hart's famous Identity 2.0 talk that I believe he gave first at OzCon. But I think it's a fantastic presentation. If you haven't seen it and have ever been stuck alone with me, I've probably told you to watch it. So I'll tell you all now, find it on, you know, Google for Identity 2.0. But there's a lot of very sort of powerful messages that sort of explain why all this is important. But one of them is he just very simply says simple and open wins on the internet. And, you know, and the email example is a great one because, yeah, I mean, you know, we don't have MCI mail and all these other sort of competing things. What we have is SMTP and these other, you know, open protocol that that anybody can implement and gives users choice, yeah, to move, you know, from their Yahoo address to their, you know, to Gmail or from a self-hosted sort of thing or from their company's thing, and we can, you know, use tools and choose between these various services and yeah, I think that's one of the, you know, one of the very components for OpenID is when we start talking about our identities online and who we are, you know, this is a simple and open protocol that, I mean, I think has a good chance of sort of winning that, you know, above and beyond, you know, things like Facebook's authentication scheme.
Well, you know, and there's one more piece that I'd add into this, which I think is also useful. You know, I get a lot of questions about the security of OpenID. You know, well, doesn't it mean you're putting all your eggs in one basket, and if your account gets hacked, you know, you're screwed, right? And the first half to the answer is, well, okay, those are really good questions, and you should absolutely be asking them. And I hope that you also ask them about your email account, because yep. If your email account gets hacked, then all of your passwords can be reset, and you can be locked out of your email account. So I hope you're doing and securing your email in whatever way that you would secure your OpenID.
And not giving it out to each new social network.
That's right. Yeah. So you can see how this problem is compounded by current behavior. The second thing, though, is that OpenID doesn't actually specify how you do authentication. And so that means that you can actually pick a provider, an OpenID provider, that can afford you with additional types of protections and assurances and security so that it's harder to hack your account. So it's sort of, because there's a lot of security thinking around OpenID, there are people who are providing services, you know, Badoop is one, Jamrin's another, that will do things like allow you to receive a text message whenever you sign into a website. Or instead of putting a password into a browser, they will send you a text message with a PIN, and then you type in that PIN number into the website to sign in. And so you essentially get two-factor authentication or two-password authentication or voice verification, things like that, at a fairly low cost in a way that allows you to secure your identity in much more than you do today with just a typical username and password. So that's another thing that I think is really interesting to think about, is how this can actually lead to a better and more secure situation than what we typically see today. So, for example, Facebook probably will not, in the near term, allow you to use some biometric token of some sort to sign into Facebook. However, people clearly have a lot of value trapped up in there. It's all your contacts, your address book, you know, all these different things. And why is that the case? Well, because Facebook deals with a large number of people. They're not going to make a change just for one or two people who are like, oh, you know, security is important. And so that's also why this element of choice is important, so that as people see the value in actually securing their identity online, there is a means of going down that path.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not Vidoop, so apologies to your employer. But one of the reasons I've used my OpenID for a long time as my provider is, again, looking at alternative authentication mechanisms. They do authentication via SSL certificate as an option. And so, you know, I mean, normally when I'm, you know, online and browsing and you know, participating in social networks, I'm doing so from my laptop, and I have a unique SSL certificate tied to my OpenID account installed in my current version of Firefox. And so, you know, sort of bringing all these things together, my typical user experience when I go to an OpenID enabled website is I enter in waka.net, which is, you know, is me, has been me, and will be me on the internet probably for the foreseeable future. It's a URL that I control, and I've used an OpenID feature called delegation to say that for that URL, I'm giving, for now, my OpenID.com authority over that. So when I log into this site, they go over to my OpenID. If it's a site I've been to before, my OpenID checks that it is a browser that it matches a certificate to. I don't even have to get involved, and it redirects me right back, and I'm logged in, and it's literally, you know, one click. I don't have to worry about remembering my password. I don't have to worry about, you know, which of the, you know, the two passwords that I always use, I've used and things like that. So, you know, it's a very nice one click sort of experience, that is far more secure than, you know, what I usually use on non OpenID enabled sites.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Cool. Is there anything else we want to touch on?
So, you know, since this is a Drupal podcast most weeks, you know, I think it's probably a good idea to. So, Chris, we sort of mentioned at the top that you're, you know, we had you out to New Orleans for the Do It With Drupal seminar. You're keynoting at DrupalCon. I can justify the crossover because I've written a lot of the OpenID code that exists for Drupal, but maybe you want to talk a bit about what the Drupal project could and or should be doing in regards to all of this.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, on the one hand, I think that we need to definitely work on the OpenID user experience and see how we can get better support for that. Getting like some of the most like recent stuff that we've been doing into Drupal, either as a prototype or just as something that you could like turn on as a, you know, experimental type of feature or whatever. There's a lot of good progress being made there. So let's make OpenID easier for people. The other thing is actually seeing OAuth be implemented as sort of a core service or a core feature within Drupal, so that any service that you make available via an API could actually be protected with OAuth. And I think there are a lot of benefits to that that are just starting now to be understood by people. For example, being able to do rate limiting against APIs, being able to even have a business model off of this, because if you want to provide really, you know, robust access to different services that you provide from your web service, then you can essentially say, well, if you want a certain quality of service or a certain robustness, you know, you can pay us and we'll make sure that your OAuth token gets that kind of, you know, preferred treatment. And so there's that part. There's, of course, talking more about it within the community and finding out, you know, how this stuff should look, how it should behave. And then there's also moving down the road, things like activity streams, where, you know, with CCK and different types of ways of creating content and creating different types of content, there's an opportunity to provide richer feeds between even Drupal sites from one to another that are better representative of who's doing what action and what is the object of that action, what is an indirect object of that action, so that as Drupal sites aggregate content from one another, they can essentially reveal richer sets of data between them. And so it's sort of like a very gradual way. I know that there's been a lot of talk within the Drupal community about things like the semantic web. Well, this is sort of a very poor man's way of getting there by providing real use cases based on technology that more or less already exists today. So right. Those are the few pieces that I'd like to see happen. In general, I think to have some more code that people can download and try and eventually hopefully make it into Drupal core.
Cool. Yeah. So just sort of as a practical thing. So since Drupal 6, OpenID relying party support has been in core. But as you mentioned, you know, Drupal 6 was released over a year ago now. I don't know, a long time ago. And absolutely all of the sort of the user experience work that you've been involved in is not yet represented. And then we've got a lot of the other pieces sort of in various states of flux. So I've been sort of partially working on time when I've got the time, working on an OpenID provider. So being able to offer up OpenIDs from your Drupal site. And then there has been some work on OAuth support. But yeah, sort of all of these things are, they're sort of in progress in various states of completeness. So,
the way in which I think we motivate this is to look at how more and more Drupal services probably are going to need to integrate with external websites. Whether those external sites are Drupal sites or not is sort of beyond the or outside the scope of the question, simply because more and more sites are actually adding support for OAuth. So if there is interest, for example, in support in Drupal, all open social APIs are protected with OAuth. So it's like, do it once, have it, you know, be done. And then the more you do it, the more familiar you become with this mechanism of doing access. And, you know, you get the benefit, of course, of integrating with all these different social networks that represent 700 million users, which, of course, I'm sure a lot of people would be interested in being able to serve. and the other thing which could be interesting, and I haven't read the Acquia roadmap yet, but there could be an opportunity to create kind of an open stack roadmap for Drupal in 2009 that sort of talks about, you know, here are the things that we could do, here's the way in which we prioritize them, and here's why we should go about doing these things first that then lead down the road to more interesting things once they've been implemented. So that might be something that, you know, I don't know if we present or it comes out of DrupalCon, but I certainly would be interested in thinking about how that might come together.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. So the other thing, speaking of at DrupalCon, in addition to you and I both giving talks on various aspects of this, the Saturday, which calendar, looks like it's March 7th, is sprint day at DrupalCon. So for anybody who's listening, who's coming to DrupalCon, I'm actually going to try to put together some corner of the sprint room to work on various OpenID and OpenStack related things. So I know I've spoken to a couple people in IRC and various back channels, but anybody who's inspired by this podcast or otherwise interested, I will try to make more information about where that'll be. I don't know the details of how that sprint day is getting organized, but I'm going to try to find a corner with a table and start building some momentum and some code around some of this stuff. So come on out. And Chris, I'd love to get a patch or two from you.
that could happen maybe in the form of some CSS.
Excellent.
We're still trying to get microformats in.
Yeah, what the heck?
Come on, folks. Come on.
Let's get real here.
Super. Well, Chris, thanks for coming on the podcast. Where's the best place to find you online? FactoryJoe.com?
That's correct.
Big text.
Which does have microformats.
Yes.
It does. It has a whole bunch of them.
Yes, actually. So for a good time, open up the source code for FactoryJoe.com. Take a look at that HTML. It's good stuff.
Awesome. If that's what you consider a good time, I feel sorry for you.
Well, you know, it's not me so much as the listeners of the podcast, I think.
Yeah, you in the sort of larger scope, but yeah.
Yeah.
We love you anyways, you whoever you are.
Or, you know, you could just look at the page without looking at the HTML, and it will tell you where Chris is right now. For instance, right now he's in Venice, Florida.
That's right.
Sitting underneath airplanes and birds. And yeah, thanks for coming on. And James, as always, thanks.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks here. A lot, Chris. And cool. I guess
we'll see both of you guys next week. Yeah.
And, thanks, guys.
All right. Take care.
Yep, cheers.
Bye-bye.